This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's been quite a couple of days for stock market news, I would say. Move over, NASDAQ. There's a new number two. The $3.5 billion taxi company on the broadcast this afternoon. And how'd you like to get a slice of the NBA's television revenue forever? Somebody does. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Monday, the 26th of August. This is the podcast for the aforementioned date. Good to have you with us today. And from the Marketplace desk of what could possibly go wrong today, a merger in the world of high finance. Two stock exchanges that you've likely never heard of are looking to get together. A company called BATS Global Markets will be buying Direct Edge Holdings and thus become the second largest stock exchange in the country. The deal, assuming it goes through, would displace the NASDAQ, which we all remember had an unscheduled three-hour hiatus Thursday afternoon. So, to review, a big merger in the ultra-competitive but little-understood world of stock trading, which is becoming increasingly prone to not working right. Marketplace's Adrian Hill gets us going today.
When we talk about BATS and Direct Edge,
we're really talking about the plumbing of the U.S. equities market.
That's Adam Sussman, director of research for the TAB Group. Like plumbing, these exchanges are mostly invisible and still very important. Sussman says if you trade online,
some of your orders are being executed at BATS and some of your orders are being executed at Direct Edge.
Some are being executed on the other exchanges. So why choose one over the other? Joe Goronsky is president at Rosenblatt Securities. He says there can be a difference in stock price. There's also the cost of making the trade, and each exchange has its own technology.
The incumbents and the challengers like BATS and Direct Edge have all spent a lot of money on servers, co-location facilities, etc., to be very competitive on the technology front.
Goronsky says all that technology makes for a more efficient market, higher volumes, super fast trades, but it does have its shortcomings, as we saw last week when the NASDAQ broke.
Because human beings aren't the ones in between every transaction now, and computers are. If there's bad code or things haven't been tested properly, that does sort of run itself through the market, and there can be problems.
And problems with this plumbing cost a whole lot of money. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Speaking of a whole lot of money, Donald Trump has spent this Monday on the defensive, as much as anybody with such a knack for self-promotion can actually be on the defensive. Trump has been sued by the Attorney General of the great state of New York. Fraud is the charge, that the Donald helped run a bogus for-profit university, charging students up to $35,000 for not much more than a series of seminars. That's a whole lot of scratch just to be associated with the Trump brand, which Sally Herships explains is exactly his point.
I know Donald Trump is a billionaire. Forbes estimates he's worth 3.2, but in some ways you could call him cheap.
I think he licenses his name to anything and everything that somebody will pay him to do it.
Hayes Roth is chief marketing officer for Landor, a branding firm.
So, you know, he's tried airlines, and he's tried soda pop, and he's tried all kinds of things.
Reality TV, women's perfume, men's cologne, chocolate designed like gold bars. The details of the deals are private, so it's hard to know what succeeded and what hasn't. But we do know Trump has declared corporate bankruptcy a number of times, and licensing his name could be a way to get needed cash.
Oh, I think he's a born entrepreneur. I think he would do it whether he'd gone bankrupt or not.
But the other thing it does is it makes the Trump brand look even bigger.
Tim Calkins teaches marketing at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. He says many of Trump's deals have run into problems, but luckily the brand is known for confidence.
And it doesn't matter if you're a senior citizen who has a dispute about a real estate deal or if you're the New York Attorney General. He is very quick to come back and say, No, the problem here is not with Trump. The problem is with you.
And it's that attitude that keeps the licensing deals coming. Market research firm Q Scores says 70% of Americans age 6 and up know Trump's name. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
That is unbelievable, that Q Score. Wall Street this Monday was cruising along into the close just to the plus side. And then traders changed their minds. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's one cab fare you're not going to be splitting with friends anytime soon. The on-demand car service Uber. It's got that smartphone app that finds where you are, gets you a car, and drops you off without you even needing to take out your wallet. It's apparently worth something near $3.5 billion, 10 times plus or minus what it was worth a year and a half ago. Ina Fried is a senior editor at All Things D, which broke this story. Ina, thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Kai.
$3.5 billion sure seems like a lot of money for this company, no?
It is. I mean, I think it's reflective of just how quickly this has caught on in this idea of using new technology to disrupt existing industries.
Which I get, but still, this is basically a brokerage, right? They are the middle person, if you will, between drivers and people seeking rides. It's not like they're making anything tangible.
It is, and it's really interesting because we think of the internet and mobile technology as disrupting middlemen, of directly connecting people, and in this case, they're adding a middleman.
We know this, it should be said, by some securities filings, but they have not officially confirmed, right? Uber has not confirmed.
They haven't. We've reported both from sources and from a Delaware filing that they've raised this money from TPG and Google Ventures, and also some other details on just how well the business is doing.
Are you impressed that they're getting money from Google Ventures? Does that sort of give an imprimatur, if you will?
Well, and this is one of the reasons that people are speculating there's more to this. You know, if we look out a little bit at the future of transportation, there is this notion that some futurists, including some at Google, have put forth that eventually we might not even need to own cars ourselves, that really cars should be an on-demand service for all. So not just the occasional taxi, but also just when you need a car, that, you know, you don't need a SUV most of the time, but there are times that you do. And really, that car should be available on demand. So this could be a bet on a future far bigger than hailing a taxi or getting a town car.
And not only that, but if Google's involved, we won't even need drivers for those cars.
Exactly. I mean, there is this notion that wouldn't it be great if cars just sort of drove around until someone needed them. You wouldn't need parking. They could park in driveways. And, you know, then when you needed them, they were available, that it would be far more efficient than this notion where we all own a car and we use it a small percentage of the time and it's taking up space, et cetera.
Uber's confrontation, shall we say, with regulators, specifically taxi cab regulators in a couple of big cities, have been well documented. Is there a downside here that this might all come to naught, or have we crossed that, you know, that threshold?
No, I think it's very much still a question mark of how should services like Uber be regulated? Should they be treated like a taxi? Should they follow the same rules? And I think we're going to see a lot of these battles. There's another service that lets you rent a car that someone else is going to park at the airport.
Yeah.
And they're getting competing from the rental car company. So I think a lot of these have open questions of how they should be treated.
Yeah. Ina Fried, she's a senior editor at All Things D. Ina, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai. Happy to talk anytime.
Rim Fire up in the Sierra Nevada near and, I guess, in Yosemite National Park is now more than 200 square miles, still spreading. The smoke is apparently so thick that airports 150 miles away are canceling flights. And the city of San Francisco has shut down two of its three power generating stations at the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir. Thankfully, only 23 buildings have been destroyed so far, but more than 4,000 others are said to be threatened. The next step for those whose homes have been destroyed is likely a call to their insurance company. But a lot of people who live in fire-prone areas can't get regular fire insurance. Instead, they rely on a big pool of money that has a surprising origin story. Here's Marketplace's David Weinberg.
Wildfires are relatively easy to predict. If you have a bone-dry forest that suffered 2 years of drought, there's a good chance it will burn. What is not so easy to calculate is how to insure the houses in that forest.
One of the most difficult things in explaining wildfire is just trying to ascertain and put a handle on what the risk actually is.
Pete Moraga is with the Insurance Information Network of California, a nonprofit that provides data for consumers. He and his colleagues recently looked at data from each of California's 58 counties and found that 2 million of the 13.7 million homes in the state sit in high to severe wildfire regions.
So when we actually did the study, a lot of people were really surprised to find out that the most homes in the highest risk were actually in Los Angeles County.
Most of these homes are in the Santa Monica Mountains, in neighborhoods like Beverly Hills, Malibu, and Bel Air. Because of the risk, nearly half of all the properties there can't get regular fire insurance. So they turn to the California Fair Plan Association.
Everybody calls us the market of last resort.
Mike Harris has worked at Fair Plan for 30 years. Fair Plan is basically a big pool of money that every insurance company in the state is required to contribute to.
It's approximately 300 companies that are licensed write property and casualty business in California. So by statute, they all have to be members of the association and participate both in our profits and our losses.
There are 31 Fair Plan associations nationwide, most of which were created after urban riots in the 1960s.
6 days of rioting in a Negro section of Los Angeles left behind scenes reminiscent of war-torn cities.
Those were the Watts riots, sparked by discriminatory housing policies and police brutality that caused years of tension to build up. It erupted in August of 1965. More than 100 square blocks were destroyed by fire and looting. Afterwards, insurance companies refused to provide coverage there.
This basically was considered redlining.
This led to the creation of the Watts Pool, money designated for insuring buildings in places where redlining was common. Around the same time, the Bel Air Canyon fire consumed the homes of celebrities like Burt Lancaster and Zsa Zsa Gabor. And these wealthy homeowners found themselves in the same shoes as the residents of Watts. So a second pool of money was created for property in the hills above Los Angeles.
So those two pools were combined to basically form the Fair Plan.
Today, the Fair Plan covers only 1.2% of the statewide market. But in the Santa Monica Mountains, Fair Plan insures nearly half of the properties. This is just one of several policies that critics argue encourages development in high-risk fire zones.
So in effect, we are incentivizing the capacity of people to move up into these mountains, to live in these canyons, and to enjoy that gorgeous real estate.
That's Char Miller, an environmental policy professor at Pomona College. The problem, he says, is that these types of incentives, whether they're in the Santa Monica Mountains or the Rocky Mountains, combined with a lack of restrictions on where houses can be built, means that the financial and ecological costs of defending those houses from fire are paid by everyone. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Would you believe a team that doesn't exist still makes $17 million a year?
Why, yes. Yes, I would. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials closed at 14,946 today. That's a loss of 64 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ ended the day at 3657. We'll call that flat. The S&P 500 down 6 points, 0.4%. 1656, the number there. Pharmaceuticals maker Amgen jumped nearly 8% today after agreeing to buy the cancer treatment developer Onyx Pharmaceuticals in a deal worth about $10.5 billion. Onyx up 5.5% on that news. Social media giant Facebook posted a gain of 2% today as the company's valuation topped $100 billion for the first time since its IPO about a year and a half ago. Microsoft down 1.75% today. The stock had advanced more than 7% on Friday, recall, after CEO Steve Ballmer said he was going to be stepping down. Bond prices, while they were up, the yield on the 10-year T-notes thus was down. 2.78% is the yield on that particular security, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano delivers a farewell address at the National Press Club. She's taking on a new role as the president of the University of California. The Conference Board is scheduled to release its monthly Consumer Confidence Index, and it's National Banana Lovers Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Banana bread, banana cream pie, banana popsicles, banana split, banana smoothies, peanut butter and banana sandwiches.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We didn't get to this in the numbers, so I'm going to slide it in right here. The dollar Bitcoin trade is about 121 bucks to the bit today, if I might coin phrase. Of course, the actual exchange rate is pretty much worthless because it's been all over the place lately, which does go some way to explaining why the federal government has been trying to figure out how to regulate the cybercurrency for a while now. The Treasury Department, the Fed, and other official types met with the Bitcoin Foundation today to discuss. Met with who, you ask? Kate Davidson reports.
The five paid employees of the Bitcoin Foundation are true believers. Assistant Director Lindsay Holland says they even get paid in bitcoins, though the exchange rate has been volatile.
So I know exactly how much Bitcoin I'm going to get every month, but I'm not sure how much that's going to exchange out for me until the date that I receive it.
The Bitcoin Foundation is made up of businesses and hundreds of individuals. They join by paying a membership fee, in bitcoins, of course. In addition to advocacy, the group provides an infrastructure for people to talk about Bitcoin's open source code. Jerry Brito of George Mason University prepared an earlier briefing for policymakers. He says the community's fluidity is different, but doesn't need to be a challenge to regulators.
Because the people who are part of the Bitcoin community are very responsive. They meet with regulators. We know who these people are, and they chat.
Sure, it's not quite as easy as meeting with Visa, but the Bitcoin Foundation does have a board its members vote for. Jason King is one of those members. Amid all the concerns about the illicit uses of virtual currencies, King founded a homeless outreach program in Florida that gets a lot of donations from the Bitcoin network.
We just fed our 13,000th meal, paid for with Bitcoin. It's definitely making a real impact here.
Of course, the Bitcoin Foundation doesn't speak for every Bitcoin user out there, which is why regulators are so keen to better understand the system and to regulate it. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Social networking, I get. You want to know what your friends are doing. You want them to know what you're doing. I got it. Social commerce, that, I must confess, is a new one for me. Websites like fab.com and thefancy.com, based on the idea that word of mouth is maybe the best marketing tool of all. Kate Betts is the person we call when I need to know something about this whole retail fashion buying world. Hey, Kate, it's good to talk to you again.
Hey, Kai, good to talk to you.
I will tell you what, Ms. Betts, I learn something new every time I talk to you. This idea of social commerce, what is this?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, starting at 4 or 5 years ago, we had these flash sale sites that came along, sites like Gilt and Rue La La. And I think technology is just moving so quickly and everybody's trying to become the next Amazon, you know, The idea of Pinterest, I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yes, come on, I don't live under a rock.
Oh, okay. So Pinterest gives you this idea of self-expression, they call it, but you can't really buy anything on Pinterest, and I think that frustrated a lot of users.
So you've got these sites like The Fancy and Fab.com. How does it work? I mean, you sign up or you become a member, or what do you do?
Well, some of them are just sign up. Some of them are invitation only. And basically, you are recommending products that you like mm-hmm. to your friends, or you're looking to your friends or to people you trust for recommendations.
And do you get a cut if they buy? Do they get a cut if you buy?
On some of the sites like Lovocracy, you get a cut of the products that your friends buy that you recommended. It's kind of like the old model of direct marketing, Avon Lady,
right.
Tupperware, all of those fun things from the 50s.
Yay, let's bring those back. Can you get good stuff there, or are you buying schlock? I mean, do you get brand names?
Well, you buy whatever you recommend.
So it's a win-win in theory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I guess if you could say like Pinterest is like a magazine, these sites are kind of like designing your own catalog.
This is all about the democratization of style and fashion and appearance and design and all that. We are now moving away from this top-down model where Anna Wintour, just to name names, tells us what we should be wearing next fall.
I love it when you drop names, Kai. it's totally... That's exactly right. It turns the whole model upside down. And it's a democracy of brands, too, because the most widely recognized brands aren't necessarily the ones where people are buying the most product.
Yeah. Talk to me for a second, Kate, about the flash in the pan risk here. I mean, you know, for a long time, the Daily Deal sites were the big deal, Groupon and stuff. Is there a downside risk?
Well, I think the biggest downside risk is the technology is moving so fast. And I don't really know, you know, I'm not an engineer, but it seems like every day there's a new idea, a new algorithm, a new code that's being written that makes, you know, adds a new dimension to shopping. And so I think that that's the hardest thing to keep up with.
Kate Betts, I learn something new every time I talk to you. Kate, her book, it's about Michelle Obama. It's called Everyday Icon. Kate, thanks a bunch.
Thank you so much, Kai.
If you're a fan of professional sports, football, basketball, baseball, doesn't much matter which, there's a time every year when you realize why ticket prices go up all the time and why a Dodger dog costs you like $7 or $8 or something. It's when payroll data comes out. How many millions of dollars, or tens or hundreds of millions sometimes, star players get. Those contracts with incentive clauses and delayed compensation and options and bonuses are legal miracles. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler looked at two notorious sports contracts that deserve their own Hall of Fame.
It's been called the best sports deal of all time, a contract so profitable it's used as a textbook example by business professors and sports reporters.
Would you believe a team that doesn't exist still makes $17 million a year?
The deal, signed in 1976, gave a small but lucrative portion of the NBA television broadcast revenues to three men. Dan and Ozzie Silna, along with their lawyer, Donald Shupak, owned a pro basketball team called the Spirits of St. Louis.
An exciting finish with 34 seconds. St. Louis 109, Kentucky 108.
The Spirits played for the American Basketball Association, or ABA. The ABA competed with the NBA. From 1973 up until the end in 1976, Michael Goldberg was general counsel for the ABA.
The league lurched to the finish line, kind of a bankrupt organization, exhausted mentally and physically, hoping against hope that there wouldn't be another ABA season because we didn't know if we could muster 10 teams to have a league and what have you.
Eventually, the ABA and the NBA struck a deal to merge. Four teams, the Nets, the Pacers, the Spurs, and the Nuggets, would buy their way into the NBA. Plus, they had to compensate the other ABA teams that didn't make the cut. In the end, only St. Louis stood between the four teams joining the NBA.
St. Louis is holding the cards because unless they agree to something, this merge is not going to happen for antitrust and other reasons.
The St. Louis owners negotiated a cut of the future TV revenues. And here's the kicker, they got the rights in perpetuity. Over the years, the deal has reportedly paid out around $300 million and counting. Back then, Goldberg says, who knew?
The concept of cable television, Turner Sports, ESPN, these things didn't exist. And it's easy today to say, wow, they made a bad deal. But in those days, it was not viewed upon that television would be the be-all and end-all, as it is today for all sports.
The business landscape is always changing. We see that again in another notorious deal.
The pitch, swinging a high fly ball, home run, Bobby Bonilla!
It's been more than 10 years since slugger Bobby Bonilla retired from baseball. Nonetheless, for the next 22 years, the New York Mets will pay him more than $1 million a year. J.C. Bradbury is the author of Hot Stove Economics, Understanding Baseball's Second Season.
It's very easy to look at from hindsight. You go and say, well, the Mets are paying Bobby Bonilla over $1 million a year to not even play baseball. How silly is that?
But he says teams defer payments so they can afford new and hopefully better players. And that's just what the Mets had in mind. Sports agent Dennis Gilbert negotiated the contract for Bobby Bonilla.
The Mets were building a championship team around that point in time. And what they were looking to do was to defer some of Bobby's money.
Gilbert structured the payments like an insurance annuity and locked in the interest rate at 8%. With interest, the Mets will pay Bobby Bonilla $30 million instead of $6 million. But even with a lower interest rate, deferred payments could work for other athletes, too. Michael McCann directs the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at the University of New Hampshire.
I think there's some logic to the idea that players may be better off when they turn 35, 40, 50 to get a substantial amount of money coming in. It may be a very valuable piece of money for them.
In 2009, Sports Illustrated reported that within 5 years of retirement, about 60% of former NBA players are broke. And in pro football, the numbers are even worse. In which case, a deferred payday can be the preferred way to get paid. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which Google's quest to take over the world moves another step closer to reality, I direct you now to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, specifically patent number 8510166, issued 10 days ago for a, and here I quote, gaze tracking system. Or to paraphrase, Google Glass is going to be watching you while you're watching it. So what? Well, how about this? Buried deep down in the fine print, a pay-per-gaze advertising system, self-explanatory, I would say, but also a sliding scale for how much those ads are worth depending on the user's emotional state. This thing, Google Glass, is going to measure pupil dilation to see how invested you are in the ads you're watching. Mind now sufficiently blown. All right, we're done. We're out of here. That is Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow off 64 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ down slightly, but we'll call it flat. The S&P 500 gave back 7 points, about 0.4%. Our producers include Lana Anwar, Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Raghu Malambalan, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.